Hi everyone. It's my first lecture for a while, so please let me know if I am mumbling or coughing or doing anything like that. But yeah, I'm Ben, and I'm going to talk about this intervention called germ defence. It isn't in the title, but I only just noticed that. It was a psychological intervention during COVID-19. I'm going to treat it like a big case study of the beginning to, I was about to say the end, but wherever we are now in the pandemic, and including the development of it, the evaluation of it, and the ongoing implementation of it. And it's turned into, it started before I probably was just about started doing my undergrad degree, but I obviously had nothing to do with it then. Loads of people. So this is sort of the current team, but we do a thing with like 100 loads of people. So. Cool. So my role, I don't know if... is there a laser pointer? No. My role is in this green box, health psychology. I don't know if that's being talked about this week or not, if anyone's discussed health psychology. So does anyone have any experience of it or kind of know what it is or anything? No is fine to say.
Yeah, I have experience, but not health psychology, medical psychology.
Okay, cool. So I'll explain it anyway then. So, you've probably heard loads about, in the last 18 months, about behavioural medicine. Certainly, that's what I read in the news quite a lot, and you know, they'll have interviews with Susan Mickey and Robert West and people like that, saying, like, this is what people should do, or stuff like that. So, health psychology is most similar to behavioural medicine, I think, anyway. And behavioural medicine is kind of getting people to do things through changing their behaviour. Health psychology is very, very similar, except we are particularly concerned, well, with the psychology of what people are doing in that change. So the change is not, you know, behavioural medicine might be getting them to change their behaviour without them even knowing that they're doing it, through changing a route that they walk along on the way to work or something, and giving them no option to walk along a longer route. But if we make them want to change, to walk a different route, they have different options, if they walk a certain route, that's kind of the health psychology. It's more concerned with what people are thinking and why they're doing what they're doing. So how can we make them want to change their behaviour? That's one difference. I have to say, they're very, very similar. It is not your kind of typical psychology, anxiety, depression, cognitive behavioural therapy, the psychology that I wanted to do when I came to do a psychology degree with no idea of what it was about. Any questions on that so far? No? Cool. Okay, cool. So what this talk is about is about this intervention called germ defence. I'll explain specifically what that is. It's about how we developed it and how we updated it and the challenges of working in behavioural medicine, health psychology during COVID-19, which obviously accelerated everything in that period. Am I in the way, by the way? Alright, cool. And then what I think is potentially the most interesting stuff, which is the subsequent dissemination implementation of that intervention and working within the current UK, I'm going to say healthcare, but public health, whatever the systems that we were very pragmatic, so whatever systems we were working within, it's about the challenges of that. So, germ defence, the rationale behind it, and this started actually a long, long time ago in pre-swine flu, but I mean it's just generally true for influenza and infectious diseases. Within the home is a key transmission path. So even in lockdown, well, especially in lockdown, when people aren't travelling anywhere, when people are staying at home, if someone has a virus, again, it doesn't have to be coronavirus, it can be anything, and they bring it home, you know, and you share your household with people, if you don't live alone, there's loads of different ways and there's multiple opportunities to transmit that virus or that infection to someone else in your household. You're kind of in this group. It's both. Similarly, if there's lots of movement going on, if you're going to work, if you're a healthcare professional, you go to, or you go to a lecture at Oxford University at 5 p.m. And then you come home. There's also opportunities to spread it to the people. people that you live with when you're out and about. If one of you is shielding and the other person is going to work, then you need to bring it home. If, as I am well aware, if you have a young child going to nursery and nursery children have no clue about infection control, I swear, it's as if they've been trained to spread infection. Then, you know, you're at risk because it's very, very hard within the home to have exposure to infection. Now the key thing, and this is something that was written about by the team in the BMJ, just as a sort of commentary article in the beginning of 2020, is actually that your chances of developing symptoms of having a, you know, a strong or a substantial infection is increased by your viral load that you experience. So the more virus that you come into contact with, it can kind of overwhelm your immune system. So the humans are able to come into contact with very small amounts of virus, whether it's a cold, whether it's flu, things like that, and not get sick, basically. This is not, you know, many people don't know this, and therefore don't bother reducing that viral load. So for example, if you go into a small room with someone who's very sick, you're very likely, because there's loads of something with the loads of virus. Whereas if you're outside, it's very hard to have that extensive exposure, so you're much less likely to get sick. And you can reduce both the chance of getting the infection, but also the subsequent severity of the infection, because you don't get, like, your immune system overwhelmed. I would note that I am a psychologist saying stuff that people have told me. And the big issue is that people tend to be fatalistic, right? So they're like, oh, well, if, and I am very guilty of this. If my little boy has a snotty nose and he's rubbing his face into my ear or something, I tend to be like, oh, well, there's nothing I can do. And however, with that in mind, that I can reduce virus transmission, I can reduce viral load and therefore have a less severe infection if I do get infected, that can increase my motivation to change my behaviour with that in mind. And there's all sorts of ramifications. Like, if I didn't just live with a little boy, if I also lived with an at-risk grandparent, it would really matter. So germ defence was originally developed in for the swine flu epidemic in 2010, so I think it got funded in 2005. It was MRC, it was the lead researchers were Professor Paul Little and Professor Lucy Yardley, who both stayed involved with the project throughout. Lucy Yardley still leads it now. At the time, we just focused on hand washing. There was no good evidence. I wasn't involved with this. There was no good evidence at the time that hand washing was in the home, no scalable intervention to support hand washing at the home. It was kind of this sort of thing that was just pretty much ignored. And so, the germ defence team developed, it was originally called virus defence actually, back in the day, developed germ defence to try and increase hand washing digitally. And over 2005, 2010, the whole digital thing was really novel as well. There just wasn't that capacity. You will not be surprised when you look at what it looked like that time ago. And we used what I'm sure you've been speaking about, evidence and theory, to adjust people's behaviour and evaluated it in a big trial. So this is what it looked like. You can see it looks really dated. We principally drew, and I'm not going to go into detail, but I'm happy to talk about it, theory of planned behaviour, the common sense model of illness, protection motivation theory. So we brought in all of these theories of infection control or of behaviour change. And the main thing they did was to focus on increasing perceived, emphasising personal and social consequences. And this was evidence-based, so there isn't a photo, a photo of Sasha comes up in a minute, but we did qualitative interviews and questionnaires and found out actually where are the key targets, what things are possible to change, what motivations are possible to change. So for example, social health consequences were something that were particularly important to people, therefore it was considered those were a thing that could be effectively targeted in a kind of informative intervention. Increasing people's skills and confidence on how to reduce that exposure to the virus. And again, it was primarily on hand washing as the primary preventative thing. Importantly, it used this, I mean, this is the latest version, but this, to all intents and purposes, was exactly the same as that Canvas Wine epidemic. Personalised context prompting to help people sort of set a habit. So it asked them to put in their current behaviour. Over the last week, I washed my hands this much in this situation, to think about it. And I mean, these are things that actually quite often you don't think about. Like, how often do you wash your hands before you eat a meal or before you eat snacks or after you go to the toilet? Now, it might be, and I'll talk more about this a bit, but we're not necessarily asking everyone to do this all the time. What germ defence does, because, you know, if you give people an impossible behaviour to adhere to, they're not going to do it, basically. You just think, well, that's ludicrous, no thanks. But what we're doing is trying to tap into, okay, what is your risk? What do you do? Do you live with someone vulnerable? If you live with, or if someone has been to a crowded place, or been to a hospital appointment, or been to get their vaccine, and been to a primary care when they haven't been out of the house for a while, perhaps then you'll be at more risk, and you may want to do some of these. And if you do them, can you build a habit on it? So we had this sort of plan, asked about how often people do it. We then gave people feedback, said, okay, look, you don't do it in this area, maybe you should work on this. We asked people to set an intention. How often are you going to do it over the next week? And actually in the original trial, people then logged in over the course of 16 weeks. So we really tried to set an automatic habit to change behaviour. Something that I could talk about all day, but I will really just mention, is that we used what's called the person-based approach to make it as effective as possible. And this is really a hallmark of the research that the team does. And I know that there are many people at Oxford who are applying it in many situations in healthcare. So basically, the person-based approach aims to understand exactly what it is that stops people doing a behaviour that makes people tick. Just get their, whatever the behaviour is, whatever the population is. In this case, the behaviour was infectious control, the population was the public, to make the intervention as effective and feasible as possible. So it might be that people don't like the look of it. It might be that there's certain words they don't like. It might be there's fundamental conceptual ideas that people need to understand. So for example, that issue about viral load. How can we present that message as cleanly as possible and overcome any barriers as soon as possible to really get people engaged in using the intervention? And we do this in loads of different ways. And to be honest, we're constantly trying to update this person-based approach and make it as practical and acceptable as possible. So it's it involves extensive and in-depth qualitative interviews with your target group users or PPI stakeholders. In this case, it might be clinicians, it might be vulnerable people living at home, it might be healthcare professionals, you know, it's anyone who uses the intervention. We also look at quantitative data from, you know, who's using it, where are they using it, who's dropping out, at what stage in the intervention are they dropping out, and stuff like that. And we just constantly try and build a picture of engagement. Why are people using it? How can we help people? Or how can we make it as acceptable as possible? And therefore, how can we increase the uptake and adherence? And ultimately, the aim is to make the outcomes good. Sasha, who recently got her PhD, which is lovely, but she's been working in germ defence since its inception. She really ultimately developed this early, or was one of the leaders that developed this thing right at the beginning. So she conducted 28 qualitative interviews and a big questionnaire, and she found, you know, some relatively, I would say, boring kind of user-centered design points. You know, people wanted really feedback on their interaction to be engaged in this intervention. There was a varied layout. They wanted them emphasized key points, they didn't read through the text to understand it, they could just, like, their eyes could leap to things, and they wanted illustrations. So that's kind of simple stuff. Fundamentally, more conceptually, there was that viral load issue. People really needed, that was a key message people needed to understand in order to motivate them to engage in using all these behavior change techniques that we had. That was a key one to try and get them to. This is what it looked like at first. So you can see, yeah, these are simple messages. You know, know, that we highlighted things with bold, emphasised information, photos, had everything nice and clear. I should note, this was trialled in primary care, so actually a lot of the demographic that we're using it and where it's really likely to make a difference to healthcare outcomes is older people. And so older people may want it to be this clear, accessible information. And it was also, as a note, a while ago. And you can see we have messages on the left, and you know, it's like a cool little patient to put this together for you to trust it. And then, yeah, but I do want to emphasise that the qualitative stuff, to me, the important messages are not that focus around the look and the feel of it and highlighting the message. It's these fundamental, where to target your key messages. Why are people not engaging with it? Do they fundamentally not believe it in what it's saying? You know, do they have beliefs that you need to rectify? So, for example, in the qualitative interviews, people thought, again, that's kind of a bit dated, coronavirus, but for original influenza virus, they were kind of concerned that viruses were airborne. It was all about coughing and sneezing, so there was no need to wash your hands at all. And they also sort of had, they said, oh, I don't want to be as obsessive, there's a bit of a stigma about constantly washing my hands. So we would put in messages to address that component. And then there'd be sort of backfire facilitators, I forgot to do it, so had it for me in content to address that, I get dry skin, things like that. So really getting to the nuts and bolts on why people might not do these behaviours and the key behavioural issues and how they can be addressed. So in terms of generating evidence for example, trial in over 20,000 people in primary care in the clinic trial, published in the Lancet. And there was a positive effect. Ultimately it reduced, I think, the effect size or the risk reduction ratio was about 10-15%. Reducing respiratory infections, reduced the frequency of them, the severity of them, the people in the general sense had less consultations with a GP and used were prescribed. And also there was a benefit for their family members, so people, there were less household infections and there were also less other infections that weren't the primary target, and we did some subgroup analysis that showed it was particularly effective for people from lower education levels, and it was equally effective across most of the household variances that we could find, like gender and age and things like that. So that was fab. Of course, one of the questions, we did this big trial, I don't know if you've been discussing this, like where do you go with something like this outside of a trial, outside of a tremendous amount of funding that it takes to run a trial like this and do questionnaires to people and have teams of people ringing up and reminding them to complete questionnaires and things like that. I have to say, it wasn't being used by loads of people, so Sasha, as part of her PhD, sort of adapted it to be useful outside of the swine flu pandemic, and so it was pushed, we updated it to make it look a bit more modern, and this is when I got involved, and then we're kind of hosting it and trying to implement it instead, like there was the WHO hand washing week they had for a while, so we tried to advertise it then, and then we were in the process of getting it adopted into NICE guidelines, although there were loads of barriers for that. It had some use, so it was a resource that was being used, so hopefully it was making some difference, but it certainly didn't have loads of uptake outside of a trial. And that's, for me, always been one of the big challenges of working in this sphere, is really targeted and effective interventions that you might develop to increase, asthma inhaler use in primary care. Outside of a trial, it's incredibly hard to implement them at a scale that is useful for digital interventions. So digital interventions, they're not like a one-off motivational interview or something when you have time to sit down and talk to them and change that one person's behaviour. They tend to work at scale with relatively modest behavioural effects that don't work for everyone, but the idea is because they're so cheap and it costs literally nothing to do it on 10 people versus doing it on one person, over time they will have a hopefully are phenomenal, and they can reach many more people for limited costs. But like, you do need to have that support, and you like, how, if you have a fantastic app, how do you apply that app in the real world? It's incredibly challenging, and there's so much red tape to do it. So one of the things that we looked at was, when does the effect come? So people in this trial were doing it over 16 weeks, and they logged in every 4 weeks to complete some questionnaires on there. And what you could see is, I don't have a laser pointer, but if you, so this is at the bottom, this is like every week they log in after they've done the intervention. They didn't do the full intervention at 2 and 4 weeks, but they did. They do the intervention here. Oh, well, yeah, here. And so, if you look, so the green, this is, what we did is we looked at how many sessions people did. So they did 1, 2, 3, or 4. And what you can see is the effect basically the same whether they did 1, 2, 3, or 4 sessions. There was an increase in their handling behaviour. Now, it's not massive. It goes from like, it's about 0.5 or something, goes from like 3.5 to 4. But that's on a scale of 0 to 5, so it's taking, on average, it's taking people from like quite good to very good. Actually, that's quite impressive if you think the average people are quite good. There's plenty of people who've been taken from like 1 to 5, and a lot of people are staying up there. But it's this stuff, if you look at this sort of effect size change, you can see after one session, the effect size is huge. Like the D is big, and then almost all of the changes that in that first session. So in terms of how do we apply this learning, so we've got the sort of quantitative evidence of what's happened. Does anyone have any idea how we might adapt germ defence based on this from a 4-session intervention? Yeah, exactly. Basically, if you're asking people to log in and over a 4-week period, it's a massive hassle. You have to like sign in and put your email address in and like remember a password. And I mean, at the time that was a hassle for people. It's now not only a hassle, but also there's loads of trust issues. I don't know anyone else, but I'm always like, if Apple say, can you put in a fake email? I can put in a fake email for you if you like. I'm like, yeah, great. And then I lose my password forever. So what we did there was, we, in order to increase further uptake based on quantitative evidence, we made it one session only, so they didn't have to log in, it didn't give them any extra information, and actually we could make that first session much more effective. We don't need to get the password, we don't have this trust issue, and we can give people the key messages immediately. So that was an example, and making it sort of a snappier version was quite handy, because obviously, end of 2019, beginning of 2020, COVID-19 rolled around. Yay. And we got some funding to try. Actually, the funding was for this implementation, really. I mean, we were going to do an evaluation, a sort of agile evaluation, but really the funding was to get it out there as much as possible and look into how we do that and what we're trying to do that. So we had these three parts: the co-design, evaluation, and and a big collaborative project between Bath, Bristol, Southampton, Public Health England, now UK HSA, UK Health Security Agency, and a few other people who just weighed in, because we basically, you know, you remember that sort of every all hands on deck spirit. So that, because that was the thing, this PBA approach, this sort of really rigorous evidence-based development updating approach that we did at the beginning, took ages. Like, it would take over a 5-year trial, you'd spend 2 years updating and optimising the intervention. We didn't have time to do that. So what we did was we set up this process of really, really rapid adaptation. So we got the stakeholder panel, which had kind of key people who would be able to weigh in on how to get people to engage as much as possible. And we met like once a week, and we sent out emails and questionnaires to people all the time, and then with questionnaires in, they built into germ defence from people using it. We did interviews with people who completed those questionnaires, we did surveys, and we looked at data. So we have this constant iterative process to try and make it person-based. If there were any barriers, we'd met to discuss how we'd overcome it to really make it as simple as possible. And we continued to do that constantly. So we updated it in March 2020. We kind of released it to the world when we were confident that it was appropriate for COVID-19, swine flu, general influenza, April 2020. And you can see, like, this is, it, in its simplest version now, this was a sort of infographic that could be circulated to people who didn't have the internet. So we really updated it and tried to make it. You can see it's a lot more, like, appropriate for the modern world compared to that beige thing. We still kept updating it. So to be honest, the funding's just about finished now, so we don't have much capacity to update it. We're still kind of keeping it going. But I would say that one of the key things at the beginning of the pandemic, everyone was very scared of COVID-19. Like, people were like, if I get it, I might die. Everyone, because we didn't really know the risk. So the key motivating risk was, here is the risk if you get the virus. This is what will happen. There's a risk to you and to your family. And so this is why you do these behaviors to try and avoid it. By the end of the pandemic, people were not worried about the risk to me. That was kind of a known quantity that some people were very concerned about, some people were not concerned about at all. On the whole, people knew that, and it wasn't going to be something that we could change their minds about and change their behaviour, because everyone was meant to do it. But what people didn't know was how easy it was, how much community transmission there was, and how easy it was to catch the virus if you're out and about. So our messaging changed from, here is the risk of you catching the virus, here is the risk if you catch the virus, to here is the risk of you catching the virus, if that makes sense. So it's changing that key risk message to try and fundamentally get people to engage in preventive throughout. And I'm not going to talk about this in too much detail, we're rabbiting on our run out of time. But we did, we added content to help people identify. You know, we're not trying to get someone who is fit and healthy and had their vaccines and at low risk and to stay at home and wear a mask in the house with their family. We're trying to get people to be motivated, to understand what the risks are, and then to be motivated to do the appropriate behaviours in the face of those risks. Again, because if you ask someone to do something really, really inconvenient, the most likely thing is they'll go, that's a waste of time, and then just switch it off. We're really trying to say, these are reasons why you might want to engage in these behaviours, and give people an accurate understanding of what adjusting their behaviour will do for them, and then they might engage in some of the behaviours to a level which is appropriate for them. You know, so for example, one of the great quotes was from an elderly participant, because to a 95-year-old, a kiss is more important with your loved ones than worrying about whether you're going to die of a virus. And it's incredibly emotional. So we actually ended up putting in content that was like, how can you get around? How can you engage in behaviours, or how can you do appropriate behaviours in the face of these risks? It was stuff like setting up your living room so you can watch films. If someone is more vulnerable in the same room, how you can sit on the same sofa far apart. It all comes down to reducing that viral load. And you can see, this is what it looks like now. People log in. We've got the first three pages on the app are the fundamental key motivational stuff. You then get to go down one of these pathways depending on your level of risk, and it kind of gives you tailored advice according to how vulnerable you are, how vulnerable your family is, things like that. And then we give people feedback. So it's really trimmed down from a big beige website with about 50 pages. And it takes, it takes about 10 minutes, but we do it quite quickly. So then, and this is the stuff I'll talk about for the rest of it, how do we get it out to people? So this has been, for me, this has been the real, I really don't actually think that as a country, possibly in the world, we have a really good grip on this problem, on dissemination and implementation of interventions like this. So it has been basically, what I'm going to talk about for the remainder of the talk is the fact that we literally did everything we could to get it to as many people as possible. And because it's digital, we can like look at what comes in, we can look at usage and see how it goes. And so we have a fairly good grip on what worked and what didn't, mostly what didn't. So we had, you can see we had like lots of members of the team were on the press. Lucy Yardy was on Sage, so she would get wheeled out sometimes by the BBC when they could convince her to do it. That we had like a Daily Mail article which really took off, and that was incredibly popular. We had, it was mentioned on in the BMJ, it was mentioned on social media, you could share it, it was on the radio, it was on the gov.uk stay at home guidance. We worked with local public health teams to message it out, and the really great thing is we can, and it worked, I mean, to some extent. I'll talk about another. So we had around 600,000 uses. I'm quite careful with my language there, because we don't know whether, we don't know whether more one person used it more than once. I mean, I'm fairly confident from our feedback, that they didn't, people didn't tend to, you know, find it really hard and come back to it again and again. Most of them in the UK, but we translated it into loads of different languages, and we did a great project with like fluent speakers who were willing to help out to do that, and we had use all over the world. Normally people took between 3 and 10 minutes on it, and had a mean rating of 8 out of 10. And these are, to be perfectly honest, as someone with a bit of experience with interventions, these are like good metrics for an intervention like this. Normally, often mean uses are like, you know, 1 minute, because most people log on and just think that's rubbish and don't go past the first page or something like that. So these, we're really happy with these numbers. And this is what, first thing that I think is really cool is you can see we get hits of like what's worked. So you can see like when right at the start, these that Lucy was talking on the internet, on the radio, and she did, there was an interview in The Guardian and stuff like that, and in The Times, about washing your hands. And then as time went on, you know, when UKR, when Alok Sharma in a press conference announced the funding, a tiny little spike, when that BMJ article came out about the importance of viral load, there was a bigger spike. When the press release came out and the Daily Mail article came out, which, by the way, they called it German defence, and people were getting really cross about actually that was really interesting, because the folks, the Daily Mail article was, they just, well, the press guys picked, they thought, this, what's an interesting thing, what's a catch here? And they picked that part of the recommendations that we had was that the initial evidence suggested that the virus would die on a surface after 72 hours. So in the intervention, we said, we try not to tell people to leave your pizza for 72 hours when it's delivered. But we try and say, the longer you leave something, and do bear in mind, like now all the evidence is ventilation, but this was right at the start where there wasn't that evidence, and it was kind of on the surface. You know, try and leave something, longer is better than not at all. If you can leave it for a day, that's great. You know, if you can leave 72 hours, fantastic, you've got no chance. But, you know, 30 minutes is better than 0 minutes. So they wrote that message. It caused a huge fury to the Daily Mail, because people immediately said, well, how am I going to eat my takeaway? But actually, what it did do is get loads of people using it, and once they used it, they realised that wasn't the key message we were saying. So it's kind of an important lesson on working effectively with press teams to release it, to try and get the things out. And then there were BBC interviews that again caused a huge spike before the press conference. Was that question, or?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the dissemination. Do you have someone to do that, or how do you do it?
Well, because we were doing so many different methods, no. And part of the issue was there was, before we did this project, there's no real guidance on how to disseminate something like this. So it became the primary job of me and Lucy in the team, really, to try and disseminate it through as many channels as possible. And outside of a trial, because a trial you have a tremendous amount of resources, you have people employed to shake people up and conflicting people up and stuff like that. You know, we didn't have anywhere near that amount of funding, and it was really about finding out the different things. So no, it was kind of me.
A lot of people just stopped watching the news because they didn't want to hear about it every day. Like, I muted a load of terms on my social media
because
I didn't want it all in my streams. I wonder if that made it even harder.
Well, maybe, but I'm about to talk about another method, which might be a few slides. And that might be true. I guess we'll never know, is the problem. But we did have another method in a bit, which I'll talk about in a second. So yeah, this is one of the cool things as well. I will whip through this. What we do get, in digital interventions, we can kind of gather all the data that's going on. So we can see, like, people fill out this quiz, and we can see, and we had ethics to do this before. We can see what current levels of behaviour are. Of course, this is in a highly motivated subgroup. I mean, that's the thing about these interventions. If you're not telling people to use it, then they tend to be already doing it. But we can see, like, how much people use. So this is analysis done last August, and you can see basically each of these bars is, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it's how many people. So the further to the left that the population is weighted, the less people are doing the behaviour. So you can see very few people are wearing face coverings at home, virtually none, which is you would expect, right? Because it's quite an intrusive behaviour. Few people are putting packages aside, quite a lot of people are cleaning, disinfecting, not that many people are socially distancing. And this is probably lower than you would expect during a pandemic, because it's not saying, you know, do you socially distance from your loved one? It's kind of, if you're vulnerable. And we could look at this within different groups. Which pathway did people go down? So we could look at, if people selected and said, I'm living with someone who's vulnerable, we had a pathway, I'm living with someone who's showing symptoms, I am showing symptoms. And you could still, these are average, so you can still see, despite a lot of these people being high risk or vulnerable or showing symptoms, there's people still aren't doing a lot of these behaviours. You could see, so we could look and we could find that people with a high risk household member were more likely to do the behaviours. People who had someone showing symptoms would be more likely to self-isolate, generally things like that. So we did find people who thought that they might have symptoms were actually less likely to clean and disinfect than people who thought that someone they were living with might have symptoms, which is interesting. So it kind of shows maybe you're putting the burden on the person who is well to clean up so they don't get it. And interestingly, all of these behaviours, these like classic behaviours, and we've now, by the way, this data analysis came before ventilation, so we now added ventilation. I believe we've taken out putting packages aside and added ventilation, opening windows. We've performed much less frequently than hand washing. Hand washing was, because do you remember at the beginning, like last February and April, it was like really pushed? It was like, wash your hands 20 seconds. And so we really adopted that. And this is the best, because it's all the one sit here. We don't have a sort of trial follow-up or anything like that. If we look at current and intended behaviours from the plan, what am I doing now, what am I going to do next, you can see there's a decent effect, small increases. But it's actually, interestingly, exactly the same data marker in the original trial showed slightly less of an effect, which is really nice, because even though we don't have that hard clinical data yet, we can think, it's our best estimate, that it might be doing something. If you have like the infection, so if we remember that reduced risk of like 10%, there's no real reason to think, well, of skepticism and being rightly skeptical about research, but this is the best marker that possibly we might expect a similar risk reduction effect of this intervention. In fact, we might even expect it to be slightly greater because the virus was much more prevalent. And because the offending behaviours that we were targeting, ventilation, social distancing, are more likely to be more effective than just. And we could also look, I mean, I'm not going to talk about this data because it is takes a long time to unpick it. But what was cool was we could also look at, you know, the 7-day rolling average of these behaviours. So you can get all that in a discipline intervention, you can understand it, you can evaluate it. Even if you don't have a trial, you can start modelling what is going on, whether you get it. And we were able to use that data, so the qualitative data, the uptake data, things like that, to inform SAGE papers, and it currently is the only, the research that comes from it is the only evidence of current infection behaviour within the paper. It's really like, it does still seem to be a slightly overlooked aspect of infection control, and I mean, our trials ended, but the infection's quite clearly still going up, as shown by this thing. And my dry throat. So yeah, this is going to the other dissemination routes as well. What we then managed to do, and this, so we, you know, we've got all these sort of ad hoc, talking to the press, talking to journalists, Twitter, social media, Facebook, stuff like that. The old GP practice would email it out. And one of our team, who's a GP, emailed it out, and we could see a little spike of like 500, 800 users that day. We know his patient, so we think that's cool. And what we ended up doing was designing a trial with a team at Bristol in the Health Protection Research Unit. And we got marked as an urgent public health COVID-19 study through negotiations with the NIHR, and it was kind of selected by Chris Whitty as this thing that meant that we got to rapidly go through ethical approval, which was really handy because, again, so we sort of managed to whip through a lot of stuff that might take you a year to do in order to get it up and running. And we're going to do, or we've nearly finished, a really big trial where we got, basically got the email addresses of every single GP practice in England from NHSX, randomised them, so 50% of them were in the control group and 50% of them were in the germ defence group, excuse me, and sent an email to every single one of them in the intervention group saying, here's the evidence for germ defence, here's how to detect the patients. And then we can look at sort of freely available routine practice data. Well, it's not quite freely available, but available routine practice data in the GP practices that used germ defence versus the GP practices that didn't, and see whether the infection rates in those GP practices were slightly lower. So I think actually it's a really exciting trial to be a part of. So we haven't completed the analysis yet, so we haven't got the data from it. But I think this is, like, you don't see trials like this. Trials normally involve like individual patients in a GP practice. By having the randomization level at the practice, we suddenly are able to conduct a real-world clinical trial, and B, implement it, disseminate it to patients via a text to their phone from their healthcare professional, which is really exciting. Now, the challenge with this was that, like GPs, that generic GP, I don't know, anyone's ever tried to email their GP? They're not brilliant at replying particularly promptly, because I'm sure they get 100,000 emails a day. And something that says, hello, we're doing a research project, is not very likely to get through to them. So it was really, really hard. And I think if we don't show any effect, it is 100% due to a lack of uptake, because that email to GP practices didn't get through. We sent them three, sent GP practices three emails. Each of those emails we piloted and we trialed and we talked them through with members of the practice and we tried to find out in a given GP practice who would receive the email. Would it be a kind of receptionist? Would it be a healthcare assistant? Would it be a partner? Anything like that. And we tried to work out how to target it and how to get the most engagement with it. And then we would even suggest behavior change texts that they could send to their patients, things like that. And the results of that should be coming out soon, which would be really exciting. But one thing to take away is that this was by far the best way of disseminating germ defence, because when it did get to patients, it came from their healthcare professional. It had that credibility, and it also had all of the work that we've done behind the scenes to help that message get through. we were kind of lucky to be able to do this. We had a sort of fact team, but this is by no means a guaranteed solution. You can't have a digital intervention that shows effectiveness and then say, well, I'll just run a national randomized controlled trial and disseminate it. Like, it's incredibly hard. And this is, for me, this is the one thing that is missing in a kind of pandemic response, or well, in a public health response like this, is I might have an intervention that works for anything beyond like a poster or a viral video. How do I get that to people? We have this National Health Service, like we have these communication systems, but there is no, at the moment, it's incredibly hard. There isn't even like, you know, a clear pathway on who you meet with, who you talk to actually disseminate something like this. Like, I know you just had a bunch of lessons on mask wearing and discussions on mask wearing. How do you, like that's a behavior, a really acute behavior. There's gonna be clear interventions that could be designed or have been designed on how to change people's behavior around masks. But again, there's no clear pathway on accessing everyone in England on getting that through. Sometimes there, of course, is with the vaccines. So that is, you know, so. But again, it's a kind of ad hoc thing that is done, and loads of stars have to align in order to do anything. And you can't. Hopefully, in the future, there will be a guaranteed way of aligning those stars in order to implement something. So, yeah. To sum up, this adaptation of demo defence enabled us to develop these really effective co-participatory methods that get buy-in from all the stakeholders to optimise these interventions. Reducing these barriers to implementation of evidence-based medicine is incredibly important. For me, the best learning, the most important learning will be what are the barriers that we faced. And how can we, not how did we, but how can we hope to deal with them better in the future, and not rely on, to some extent, being lucky, but I mean, being, what I would say is ad hoc, and, you know, if an opportunity comes up, what can we do? If a public, someone in, I mean, we had to get it on the gov.uk website, so it's currently on the guidance for multi-generational households and reducing infection if someone has it. To get it on that website, it took almost the entire length of the project, 18 months, despite the fact that we had, unlike almost everything else, we had an evidence base right from the start, and we had two people from, quite senior people from Public Health England working in the research team, and we still found it incredibly hard. And some of the learning, we had a sort of reflective discussion meeting actually last week, and both Richard and Tim on the team were like, we thought this would be a lot easier than it was, but this, even within Public Health England, there still isn't a clear channel. We don't even know who the gatekeepers are to try and march forward with it. It's just incredibly interesting, and so that identifying and reducing barriers, hopefully our work will help identify some of the barriers. And I really think, yeah, the innovative co-participatory adaptation, so constant updating, how do we incorporate people's views so it's constantly effectible in a hugely changing context. I know the pandemic was really rapidly changing, but actually anything digital is constantly being updated. So if you have any digital behaviour change components, it's like, you know, the platform, the phone, people's habits, what apps they plug into, constantly updating, and how can you keep up with that is some of the methods we developed of incorporating that data already. So that's about it from me. Thank you for listening. And yeah, like I said, there were loads of people involved in it, so, and this is actually not all of them, but the end.